And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Gemma B. from L.A.
Hi, my name is Gemma, and I'm an alcoholic. Hello. Look how many people there are. Wow. I'd like to thank Larry for asking me to speak. It's an honor to be here. And I'd like to say welcome to all the newcomers. You know, if you're new and you just feel done and you're so happy to be here and this just is so exciting for you, I'm so happy that that's your experience. That was not my experience. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was sad. I was scared. I was really depressed. I felt broken and I thought my life was over. I was 19 years old. I was bitter that I had gotten here at 19. It was illegal for me to be drinking, and I felt that it should be illegal for me to have to stop drinking. And when I was a little girl, and, you know, people would play house or whatever, I liked to pretend that that I was Betty Davis. And I had seen her in black and white movies, and I used to go into my room and close the door, and I would wear just a slip, and I would have a martini glass of water and maybe some black olives, and I would line up my dolls, and I would swirl my martini. And I would hurl insults at them. And if you asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I knew enough to say, a ballerina. But the truth is, I wanted to be a mean, nasty drunk. That's what I wanted to be when I grew up, you know? I did not want to be happy, joyous, and free. I did not want love and tolerance to be my code. So I got here not because of anything on my part. I got here because my father is a therapist and my mother is a priest. My father is in AA and my mother is in Al-Anon. I am an only child. There were no pink elephants anywhere near our house. And so I told them exactly what was going on with me. And they said, you know, my dad didn't say anything, but my a few days after a really terrible alcohol poisoning, I went up to their house and, you know, I was like, so what should we do? You know, I had blacked out on 9th Avenue in the middle of the night. And I was like, should we go to a movie? And my dad sort of left the room and my mom had the one single tear and the broken heart and the whole thing. And she tried the, like, loving tactic. And then she said, here's the deal. The school you're going to is very expensive, and at the rate you're going, we think you're going to die, and it's not a good investment. So I was here on a tuition program, and when I got here, I was super resentful, and I felt like you were lucky to have me, and I was not going to do 12 steps. I only drank for 6 years. I was going to do 6 steps. I did them in my chair. I was not going to get a sponsor because everyone's sponsor sounded great, and I was sure I wasn't going to be able to find a good sponsor. So I sponsored myself, and we felt that... First things first, and easy does it meant I could still smoke pot. And so I had to adjust my time later. But so what happened was I came here. I would go, you know, once a week, and I finally did get a sponsor. And I cried all the time, you know, and I was haunted by this feeling that I wasn't an alcoholic. You know, I'm not an alcoholic. This happened by accident. I accidentally got sober. And I remember crying to my sponsor, and I said, you know, please, please tell me that it gets better. And she said, honey, it doesn't. And I was like, where do I report you to, you know, to the powers that be? That's a terrible thing to say to a newcomer. And she clarified. She said, absolutely, your life gets better when you put down drinking and drugs. Absolutely, it does. She said, but it is life, and life is going to continue to happen whether or not you're sober. And you are going to have to live life on life's terms. You know, people are going to get sick. You're going to want jobs that you're not going to get. You're going to want to marry people who don't know who you are. And she didn't say that. That was my experience. But a lot of stuff is going to go down. Hopefully you'll be sober for a long time, and a lot of stuff is going to happen. She's like, so I can't promise you that it is going to get better, but I can promise you that if you go to meetings and if you get a higher power and if you continue to have a sponsor and you, you know, read the book and do what it says, I promise you that you will get better and that no matter what happens in your life, you will not have to face it alone. I'm coming up on 16 years next month, and that is my absolute experience. And, you know, I had this thing for me, this huge loophole of whether or not I was an alcoholic had to do with my age, you know, but I've heard other people have it, you know, I only did drugs, or I'm too old, or I was too far down. I didn't go down enough, whatever it is, you know, mine was, I was too young, you know, and, couple things happened. The biggest thing is that I went to a meeting one day when I had 4.5 years, and I went there because I had a commitment, because I remember specifically not wanting to go there that day. But I went there because I had a commitment, and I heard a woman speak, and she started in her story when she was born, and she, 15 minutes into her story, was 9, and she talked about alcoholism, but not drinking. And I identified with her so deeply that I just started crying. I just started sobbing because I had been here for 4.5 years wondering if I was an alcoholic and being out with people drinking and feeling like I didn't fit in there and then coming here and feeling like I didn't fit in here. Not because anyone told me I didn't, but because I told me I didn't. And I heard this woman speak about alcoholism, and I was able to admit to my innermost self that I had this thing, that I did not get sober by accident, that I got sober by grace, and that I am an alcoholic through and through. And I started to cry really hard. And this great old-timer at my meeting, Chuck, came up to me at the break, and he was like, "Who died?" And I'm very dramatic, and I was like, "Chuck, a piece of me." And the piece of me that wondered if I had this thing absolutely died that day. And I have had moments where a drink sounded good since then. I have had moments of wanting to drink, but I have never, ever, ever questioned my alcoholism since that day. And if you have not heard your story here, just keep coming, because, you know, it took me 4.5 years, and it could have been faster if I made it to more meetings, but slowed that down. But what she shared about was the disease of perception. And one of the things that helped me stay as long as I did is, you know, it talks about like there are the 20 questions about whether or not you're an alcoholic. And nowhere does it say, like, did you try this? Have you tried that? You know, the specific drink or the specific drug. It talks about the emotions, why we drink, not what or how much, you know. And my bottom is when I stop digging, you know. And she talked about how as alcoholics we perceive the world differently. We have a different perception. I have a different perception as an alcoholic. And for what that looks like for me is that I have a very negative, my default is very negative. I have a feeling of doom that I used to think was women's intuition. That deep feeling like this is not going to work out. I have thinking that is black and white. You know, my thinking is all or nothing. And on my own, I can't see what I've learned in sobriety is the gray in the middle. You know, just recently it was my mother-in-law's birthday and I wanted to get her something. It was, you know, $200. And it didn't make sense, you know, to get her that because, you know, it was a lot of money. And then I was like, well, I just won't get her anything. And, you know, not smart with mother-in-laws. In between $200 and nothing, there are flowers. You know, there's a medium ground, which I found, thank God. But that's how I operate, you know. You know, it's like, oh, I'm going to meditate? Okay, well, I need to go to India for a month. Oh, I can't go to India? Well, then I can't meditate. Sorry. I have what I call NAG in my thinking, the words never, always, and global, which is like everybody. And so it's like, you know, when I am thinking in that way, like I'm never going to be always everyone else, you know. I have to be really careful with my language, especially with that everybody hates me. You know, it's like, okay, who hates you? Well, John, you know. Does John hate you? No, he's mad. Why? Well, because I didn't show up. Oh, okay. You know, it's very easy to think that everybody hates me. There's nothing I can do about that. You know, oh, well, everybody hates me. What can I do? But if John is mad because I don't show up when I say I'm, then there's something that I need to do about that. Sometimes I don't want to look at that. But you know, that's my alcoholic thinking. This feeling that I'm right around the corner from happy, but I just need one more thing. You know, my first 7 years, it was like, I just need to be in a relationship. I just need to be in a relationship and then I will be totally fine. I just need to find, oh, I found someone. You know, because it was like that book, Are You My Mother? But for me, it was, Are You My Boyfriend? And I was like, Are you my boyfriend? So I finally found my boyfriend and let me tell you, I was so shocked that the voice that said, you're never going to find someone, didn't go away. I thought the answer to that voice that said, you are never going to find someone, you're unlovable, was to find someone. And then it just said, you're going to leave. He's going to leave. He's going to die. And then I would think about, like, he's going to die. And I would be driving to work, and I would, like, think about it. And by the time I got to work, I'd be in tears, you know. And I worked with normies, and, like, they were like, are you okay? How do you say, like, my boyfriend died in my head twice? Two different ways. So I have this sort of all or this. So sorry. So yes, I was then the voice was like, okay, well, we just need to live together. We just need to live together. And then when we lived together, I was like, oh, I need a ring. And then I got a ring and then was like, I just need to know that the wedding was going to go okay. And then I was going to be happy. I can't be happy because I'm wedding planning and bridezilla. Rah, rah, rah. And just let me get to the wedding and then I'll be totally happy. And then I just need to make sure the honeymoon's going to be okay. And then I got home from the honeymoon and I was like, we can't live here. We just need a bigger place. We just need a bigger place. And then I'm going to be totally fine. When we have a bigger place and we're fine, everything's going to be fine. And then we got a bigger place and I was like, there's an extra room. We got to put a baby in the room. Got to put a baby in the room. Got to put a baby in the room. And then we put a baby in the room, and he was, like, healthy and happy and so great. And I was looking at him, and I was in the nursery, and I just thought, like, oh, my God, all I need is a career. And so that's all I need. And then I'm going to be totally happy. And when my son wasn't enough, I finally got it. Like, I finally got it. Like, oh, it's never going to be enough. it's never going to be enough. I can keep going out there and getting things and bringing them to the altar of my alcoholism and be like, here, I got that thing you told me to go get. And my alcoholism is never going to be like, well done. I got nothing. I'm proud of you. Never. That part of me is just going to say, you're not going to get what you want. Oh, you got it. You're going to lose it. That is a self-centered part of me. And when I make that self-centered part of me my higher power, I am miserable because I cannot satisfy it. I cannot. And I have, you know, since then, I have gotten a job that I absolutely love. And part of this job that I love, part of the downside of it is that every year it's up for, I have to be invited back. So I had a couple weeks that it ended, and this was last month, that my job had ended and I had to wait to see if they wanted me back. This is not a good place for an alcoholic. And so I'm waiting. And I have this part of my alcoholism, I connect things that aren't connected, you know? So, you know, like I'll miss my exit and then I'll think like, I'm a terrible mother. You know, like these two things are not connected. So something happened over here and I connected it to the thought of, they're not going to invite me back. Who would want someone like me back? They're not going to invite me back. And I got that in my head on a Friday. And then it occurred to me that I was being in the results and that I didn't know and that I should pray and go to a meeting. But then I thought, nah, I'm going to think about it. And it says in the big book, beware of the deliberate manufacture of misery. And for this alcoholic, this is the factory, my mind. And the factory was open. We had sweatshop hours. We worked round the clock. So I made it up. So I decided, I envisioned the call coming in that I did not get the job. And then I started to imagine, you know, having to tell my friends when they were like, oh, did they invite you back? And me being like, no. And then I envisioned, like, how are we supposed to pay our bills? And then I started thinking about talking to my parents and then about looking for another job. And if they didn't invite me back, who would invite me back? No one. I'm never going to work again. And basically, by picking up that idea, I got on the bullet train to Crazy Town. I was beside myself within an hour, and my husband came in and found me on the floor crying. And he was like, how are you? Did something actually happen? But it took a good 2 days to get back, you know? And for me, my disease centers in my thinking. And for me, I have to, you know, every time I drank, something bad didn't happen. But every time something really bad happened, I was drinking. And now, with my alcoholism now, it's like not everything I think ends up badly, but any time I behave badly, it's because I was thinking. It was because I went on a thinking binge and I didn't bring it to the solution, you know? And I have an alcoholic translator, you know? I have this alcoholic translator that helps me interpret the world, you know, and tells me what's happening. And then I have these, like, very alcoholic reactions, you know? And so my husband gets the brunt of it, but one time he came in and he said, oh, hey, did you get cat food? And I started to cry. And he was like, what did you just hear? And I said, you said I was a bad wife. And he was like, I actually didn't say that at all. And another time, you know, he got upset with me about, like, crackers. I let these very expensive Whole Foods crackers dry out, and he was upset. And my thought was, like, I'll move out. Like, we're not going to be able to pull it back from here, and you shouldn't have to live this way. So all of this is to say that when people say, why do you still go to meetings? You know, you have 15 years. That is why. I don't have a drinking problem today, and I haven't for over 15 years. I could get one in 2 seconds. But I do not have a drinking problem today. I have a thinking problem today. And in order to deal with that, I have to come here for my solution. And my solution, you know, when the symptoms of my alcoholism were, you know, that I had hangovers and all the stuff that I did drinking, I came here for the solution, and the solution is the same for the thinking problem that I have and all the hangovers that brings me. And for me, what the solution is, you know, first of all, coming to meetings, because I think differently than people. But if I come to a room and I can share it and you can laugh about it, I know I'm not alone. And alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and insidious, but I heard it said once, the one mistake it makes is that it's the same in all of us. And if I can recognize it in someone else, I can recognize it in myself, and I can realize, like, I have a choice today. I have alcoholism. That means I can drink myself to death, or I can be sober. And, okay, great, so I'm sober. I can think myself to death, or I can be, you know, sober. I can be part of the solution. And going to meetings, I don't know what it is about meetings that works, you know, but it absolutely works. And when I first had my son, I stopped making it to as much meetings, and I felt selfish for being away from him. And when you're away from meetings and then you start to think about it too much, like, it doesn't really make sense. I'm like, what is a meeting really? It's just people in a room. I don't need to go, you know, and then you start thinking, like, well, this would be a good time to call my sponsor. I know what she's going to say, done. And, you know, this would be a good time to pray. And this would be a good time to do a 10-step. And then I wasn't doing anything. I was just thinking about my program. And, you know, at the end of the meeting, I don't know if you say it here, but we say, you know, we don't say it works if you think about it. You know, we say it works if you work it. And so for me, my first step took me a long time, you know. It took me a long time. And then I did the second step, and I had to get a higher power, right? So for me, the thing that has helped me so much with a higher power is being a mom. And that is because I used to have this relationship with my higher power that I was like, gosh, I feel so connected to my higher power sometimes when I'm getting what I want. And and then all of a sudden, he drops me when I don't get what I want. And then I had a kid, and I had to be, you know, a caring higher power for this baby. And he hated to be taken care of. You know, he hated to be washed, he hated to be fed, he hated it. And I had to do it anyway. And there was a lot of room for him to be annoyed with me, but, like, I knew it was my job. Like, my son taught me that you can love someone like crazy and still say no. And, in fact, say no because you love them like crazy. And my son had all these great ideas, you know, like, I'm going to, you know, he wanted to go out this door. We had this back door, and he wanted to go out the back door so badly, but I couldn't let him because I knew that on the other side of that back door were concrete steps, you know, that went straight down. And every time I stopped him from those steps, he was like, he looked at me like, if you loved me, you would let me. But I knew what he thought he wanted was not what he actually wanted. He wanted He did not want to have the pain that that would, you know, actually mean. And so, but there were so many times in my story, in my life, where I felt like that with God, where I basically said, like, if you loved me, you would let me fall down concrete steps, you know? And then the other thing that is so, like, with him, my son, I had to, last year, he wanted to go to the ocean. And he's three now, so he's about two. And he was like, you know, I want to go to the ocean. I was like, absolutely, let's go to the ocean. I said, we got to do four things. We got to have breakfast. You got to get dressed. You got to put on sunscreen. We got to pack the car. Reasonable. And, you know, he's two. So, and then he just started fighting me. Eggs are flying across the room, and, you know, he will not get dressed, and he will not put on sunscreen, and he's taking things out of the car. And he just looked at me finally, and he said, I want to go to the ocean. And I was like, this is what going to the ocean looks like. And I said, you know, I'm not ignoring you. I'm preparing you for what you want. And the minute those words, which flew right over his head, left my mouth, I knew that that is how my higher power feels about me. I am not ignoring you. I am preparing you for what you want. You know, when I got here and I was like, I really want a relationship and a big career and a really big, blah, blah, blah. And people were like, make coffee. And I was like, no, I'm sorry. No, I want a relationship and a big career. And I don't know where I'm going to live, you know. Do the steps. It's like, you're not hearing me. And so for me, it's like that's what this is all about, is like I do this program and I work the steps and I do all this. I put my program first. I put AA first because I was taught anything you put in front of your program, you're going to lose anyway. And so that's what I do. And what I was told is put AA first and everything else will work out. And that's been my experience. So that's my relationship with my higher power. And then, you know, in the third step, we make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Like, well, I was working with a sponsee, and we looked up the words, and another word for will is desire, and another word for care is protection. So I think of the third step as turning my desires over to the protection of God. I do not know what's best for me. I have no idea. I'm wrong all the time. So I just turn my desires over to the protection of God. I don't ask for anything specific, and I, you know, I pray in a general way, and I don't ask anything because I don't know what that means. You know, I think I know what that means, just like my son thinks he wants to go down concrete steps, but I don't know, you know, and so I'm careful of that. And how much? Oh, okay. So when my husband and I, before we had our son, we moved into this house. And I was so excited because in the backyard there was a lime tree. And I'm from New York, and so having a tree that bore fruit made me feel like a farmer. I was thrilled. And it also had a pool, but who cares? And so we had all these barbecues, and people were like, what can I bring? And I was like, don't bring limes. We have a tree. And so we had people over, and I was so excited, and I went over to our lime tree, and I took the first lime, and it tried to cut into it. It was hard as a rock, and I was like, oh, I'm embarrassed. Well, that's okay. My crop isn't ready for harvest. It's fine. We'll wait. And so the next week, same thing. And the next week, same thing. And pretty soon I just felt like the tree was mocking me. And it fell off the tour of the house. And then I just started to resent it. And then it became like a symbol of how things don't work out for me. And then I grew to hate the tree. And then pretty soon I hated citrus in general. And the summer was over and good riddance, as far as I was concerned. And one day in November, I came home and my husband was sitting in the living room eating an orange. And I knew that I had not purchased it. I was like, "Where did you get that?" And he said, "From the lime tree." And we went outside. And our lime tree was actually an orange tree. And he said, "Who told you it was a lime tree?" And I said, "Nobody. It just looked like one." And that's what it's like to have alcoholism, because nobody told me it was a lime tree. It just looked like one. And then I had expectations of it to behave like one. And when it didn't, I resented it. And how many people and jobs and situations I have in my life where I have expectations of them to behave a certain way, and when they don't, I resent them. But resenting someone for not being the one when they're not the one is like resenting an orange tree for not giving you limes. You know, it's pretty pointless. And because I have a lot of resentments, you know, like because that's how I operate. And so I'm so grateful that we have inventory. I'm so grateful for inventory. I did not do an inventory on the tree, but I should have. I should have, because the word resentment comes from two words, one being, I think the Latin for sentir, I'm not sure, but like it, to feel, and then re. So basically what a resentment is a re-feeling. So anytime I'm re-feeling something, that's a resentment. Every time I think about the person, I go, "Oh, that's a resentment," because I'm re-feeling. When I have like, you know, sort of like my alcoholic mind is sort of does this flashbacks of like my most embarrassing moments, and it just like plays them whenever I am having a good time, you know. And those are resentments. And so for me, the first time I had to do a four step, it took me forever. I was on it for 2.5 years. And by on it, I do not mean I worked on it. I mean that it was on my to-do list and that I shared about it for 2.5 years. And finally someone was like, "Why don't you give yourself the gift of getting it done?" And I know she meant, and all of us who hear about it every week. And what I was told about resentment is that it's just an inventory like they do in a store. And when they do an inventory in a store, they're like, "Oh, we have too much corn and not enough peas." You know, they don't like take each can and go like, "This stupid corn. We have the worst corn in town. Our manufacturer is awful." They just count it, you know. And so that's what an inventory is, right? And then I get to say what my resentment is. And I used to just do that. That used to be what my inventory was, like who it is, why I'm mad. And I didn't want to find my part. I didn't want to have a part. And now, this is going to sound so lame, my part is my favorite part of an inventory. Getting down to what I'm doing. And the reason that that is my favorite part is that if there's something that keeps happening, it means that there is something I keep doing. And if I can figure it out, with the help of an inventory and a sponsor, then I have the opportunity to not do that thing anymore, which means I am not a victim of my life today. And part of being an alcoholic for me is that I take everything personally. And so many of my resentments are not personal. The other person is just doing what the other person is doing, and I am taking it personally. And to go on another citrus metaphor unrelated to the tree, it's sort of like if you get lemon juice on your hand. If you don't have a cut, it doesn't hurt. But if you have a cut and you get lemon juice, it stings. And for me, so many of my resentments come from the fact that I have a pre-existing wound. I show up to the table with this pre-existing wound. And for me, it's that I am not enough. And so anything that anyone does, and that could be from something someone says or something, you know, someone cutting me off or whatever it is, I interpret that as, you know, validation that I am not enough, you know, and I take it personally. The other person is just doing what the other person is doing, and it usually has nothing to do with me. And my resentment usually is not what the person did, but what I think that means. You know, it's like my husband says something. What he said is okay. It's just that I think that means he just said I'm a bad wife. You know, and so that's why I go through life with all these resentments, because I'm constantly taking it to the next level. Oh, well, then that means this, and then that means that, and then that means that, you know. And I'm so grateful that I have the opportunity to do an inventory and to get to the bottom of that. And I do not do a nightly inventory. I should, but I don't. I do one when I'm in the mood for freedom, and I always get it. And why, I don't know, the things that bring me joy in this program, like, it's so hard to remember to do those, but the things that bring me pain, I'm like, let's try that again. Like, let's try eating ice cream over this. Let's try that again. And then, for me, doing that inventory and then the important part of doing that inventory is sharing it with my sponsor, because an inventory just with me is still just my thinking. But when I turn it over to my sponsor and I let her see my secrets, alcoholism for me festers in like the darkness. And when I open up to her, I crack the light and my alcoholism can't thrive in the darkness anymore. And usually in my mind, something is so awful that I've done. You know, it's so disgusting and terrible. And then I can call her and she's like, I did that. You know, and it takes away that shame. And then, you know, there's the sixth and seventh step where I get to take a look at my defects of character. And, you know, I've heard the sixth step the sixth step is not doing what you want to do. And the seventh step is doing what you don't want to do, you know. And so, you know, like not drinking and going to meeting and being of service. And when I first started the sixth and seventh step, I felt so like damaged and like I'm so defective. And really, it's not about getting perfect. It's not about getting perfect. It's about getting out of myself enough so that I can help another alcoholic. And the thing about that I've learned from my experience is that character defects and character assets are really close together. Like, they're really similar. It's just like there's a little too much here and we're missing a little bit over here, you know. But that my defects can be turned into assets, that they're not all bad. It's just that I'm using them in the wrong way. And I was doing laundry recently and I thought, like, it's a little like Clorox bleach, because like if you use bleach incorrectly, like you can ruin laundry, which I've done. And if you really use it wrong, you can kill someone, which I haven't done. But if you use it properly, like nothing gets whites whiter. You know, it's a good thing. if you follow the directions. And for me, that's what, like, my assets and my defects, it's like they're so closely related to each other. And as I get more sober, like, I feel like it's that feeling of, like, shouldn't I be completely better by now? Like, and two things on that. One is that someone told me, I was like, oh, gosh, I have this much time and I'm still, you know, dealing with this thing. And she said, you know, she had 30 years and she was like, thank God. You know, I'm grateful that I still have some defects and some pain because it's what keeps me coming back. If I showed up here and, like, all my defects were removed and everything was perfect, like, I wouldn't keep coming back. For me, you know, they say pain is a touchstone of growth, of spiritual growth. And if I didn't have pain, I would not keep growing, you know. And so, though I would never say, like, God, please send me a difficult situation today. Please send me pain. I wouldn't do that. But it is those experiences that bring me closer. And it's also an experience of, like, it's like that, the, you know, those shows like Hoarders and Clean House and those shows, like, which I was really obsessed with when I just had my baby, when I wasn't going to meetings. but the thing about it is, like, when I showed up here, I was such a mess, you know. I was like one of those houses and Hoarders, you know. There's just stuff everywhere, and when there's stuff everywhere, you can't tell that, like, the kitchen table's broken, you know, because you can't see it. And so for me, being sober, it's like uncover, discover, discard. I think of it as like cleaning a house. So it's like there are things, as I get better and as I get healthier, there are things that have worked for me for years that I haven't even questioned, and then I realize, like, oh, this is broken. I didn't realize that this table didn't work because I didn't ever try to use it before because I couldn't see it. And now it's here, you know. And for me, one of those things was that I had a terrible problem with sugar. Every time I ate sugar, like, I would first be hilarious, and then I would be mean as a snake, and then I would pass out. And it was much like drinking. And one time I was about to eat a piece of cake, and my friend was like, oh, you're going to be so mean. And which was nothing that anyone could see or tell me about when I was hungover and drinking, and, you know, like, then it was like, oh, please don't sleep with my boyfriend, you know. So it's like, no one was worried about me being snippy, you know. So, and so now it's like, you sort of using the steps, like, I don't eat sugar anymore, and I haven't for, like, almost 10 years. And now it's like I eat a raisin and my day is ruined. But it's like that didn't used to affect me because I was doing all this other stuff. So I guess what I'm saying is it's like the road gets narrower. And like where I used to have these wild behaviors that weren't okay, it's like it becomes smaller and smaller things that I'm doing that are not okay. But that I get to, like, bring that into the steps and work on those defects of character, you know. And then I get to make a list of those people that I have harmed and make amends to them. And I have, you know, a conscious contact with a higher power, and I get to, you know, do all of these steps in all of my affairs. And one of the things that I've learned here is that I have to work my sobriety in the same way that I worked my using, you know. I learned, it's like everything I need to learn, I learned in kindergarten. Like everything I need to learn about being sober, I learned from the way I drank. Because I know what it's like to turn my higher power, turn my will and my life over to a higher power. Because that's what I did every time I drank. And I know how to show up places, you know, and I know how to get, if I needed to get something, I would go to any lengths. And I know how to get in touch with someone, you know, from my using. And, you know, it's like, it's the same thing like with a sponsor is like, you know, if I had a sponsee who was saying like, well, you know, she called her old sponsor and her sponsor didn't call her for 2 weeks. So her sponsor didn't call her back for a few weeks. So she like never called her again. And it's that thing of like, you know, if you're using and it's like your dealer didn't call you back, you wouldn't be like, well, I'm going to let 2 weeks pass. It's his turn. So I just have to work this program like I worked my alcoholism. And when I got here, I thought that saying I was an alcoholic meant that I was broken. And I'm not broken. There are certain things that I did that weren't working anymore, but I am not broken. And I'm not a completely different person because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I can go out and become that person that I used to be in a heartbeat. What I have in Alcoholics Anonymous is an invitation every day to be the very best version of myself. And sometimes my RSVP is, no, thank you. But then I have another chance, you know. I have another chance. And I went through a time in sobriety when I wanted to drink. I had just gone through a breakup, and it was really, really difficult. And I called my sponsor at the time, and I said, I want a drink. And she said, where are you? And I said, I'm at the International AA Convention. And she said, where are you going to drink? And I said, I don't know. And she said, well, what are you going to drink? And I said, I don't know. And she said, I don't think you want to drink. I think you want to feel better. I know everything about trying to make myself feel better. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have the chance to get better. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, not only am I not dead and I'm not drunk, I am a naturally selfish person who is happily married. And I am someone who couldn't take care of myself. And I'm somebody's mom. And I am someone who could barely get out of bed. And I'm a productive member of society, and that is absolutely because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so grateful to be here and for my life today, and I just want to say Happy Mother's Day to all the sober moms out there. Thank you so much for listening.